If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
And we are back on Paul Listaic Behind the Curtain. Now, we're going to do a little shift from that local building called the Uptown Theater, which is so magnificent. But while we're going to go to Paris and talk about the Louvre, we're doing it with a guest who knows Chicago well because she lived here for quite a while as a journalist. Let's say hello to Elaine Cholino. She's the author of a new book called Adventures in the Louvre. I try to say that as French as I can. How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. Elaine, it's so good to see you. You lived in Chicago and now you're in Paris. We miss you.
Well, I miss Chicago, but Chicago stays with me because just listening to your accent brings back my Buffalo accent. And because we all, you know, I tried to get rid of it, but I still talk in French with the accent I picked up in Buffalo and Chicago.
And by the way, when you were here, you worked for Newsweek magazine.
Yes.
And that I'm guessing good training ground here for where your career went.
Well, it was fabulous. I mean, I was the result of affirmative action. The Newsweek women won a lawsuit and I got to go to Chicago as a summer intern with the best bureau chief in the whole world. He had been a Chicago Daily News veteran, and he when things got rough, he smoked cigars and drank martinis, and every year took us to Wrigley Field, and we had a blast together, and I learned so much about journalism that I take with me today.
And it sent you on to become, for a while, the bureau chief in Paris for the New York Times. And you've written 5 books. And so what a great career. Let me take you to the book, because one of the ways you start off it is you note that this was one of the very sort of rare buildings, which was not built to be an art museum. This was a military fortress, other things.
Yes, it started out as a military fortress in the Middle Ages, and it was cold and unfeeling and unlivable. And then the kings tried to make it livable, but it didn't really work. And then Louis XIV decided to leave it and go to Versailles. So it moves from being a fortress to a palace, and then finally, with the French Revolution, becomes a museum. But it still doesn't work. It's sort of like a It kind of is like if you had a wonderful house in Chicago and you tried to renovate it 20 times with 20 different architects, it just would never kind of make it.
Well, one of the reasons, and you detail in the book, it's such a really fascinating book, but you talk about how this structure, I won't give all these details, but 92,000 square feet, 56 small buildings, 23 of them are galleries and there's passageways. And you say that basically it's a combination of chaos and also an organic feel to it. And it's disorganized and complicated and forbidding. But all you got to do is find one work of art that you love and all is forgiven.
And walk through the museum without a plan. You know, when people say, I have to go see this, I have to go see this, they're going to get lost. And the best way to go to the Louvre is to just say, I'm going to embrace this place as an adventure, like a forest, like Little Red Riding Hood in the woods. And realize that you're never going to see all 30,000 works that are on display, because to do it, even if you spent 15 seconds in front of each work of art would take you 145 hours.
Well, and you do say in the book, you say, look, you're going to get lost once you get inside. But most people, I agree, and you write this, you say are often coming there looking for something. My guess is the number one thing they're looking for, point me to the Mona Lisa.
She's both a blessing and a curse for the Louvre. I mean, can you think of any other museum in the world that is identified with one work of art? No, not even the Met. You think of the Met, you think of maybe the Temple of Dender, but maybe not.
Even the Art Institute in Chicago, you've got George Seurat. There are some major pieces here, but yeah.
But you don't think of one, you don't say, I've got to go to the Art Institute because I have to go see. No,
right.
But you have to go see the Mona Lisa at least once in your life. And when I say she's a blessing and a curse, she's a blessing because she brings so many people into the museum, but she's a curse because there's always a traffic jam and a bottleneck in the room that she inhabits and also the rooms around her.
She's also pretty small. I remember when I saw her, I'm like, that's it. And you, I want to ask you the question you kind of opened chapter three with, which is about this, which is there a way to explain the cult of Mona Lisa? Why is it such a big deal?
It's fascinating because even when she was painted, she was extolled as something as a great painting. But she really became famous in 1911 when she was stolen. Actually, there's a good journalism story here because the theft of the Mona Lisa coincided with the production of pulp newspapers around the world. It became cheap to produce daily newspapers, and so she became a daily kind of newspaper story. She even led the New York Times when she got stolen. Can you imagine that happening today if a work of art
Wow.
stolen from a museum?
If somebody go up to the average person, like, who was Mona Lisa? They don't know, but some would probably say, well, maybe she was a saint, or is a saint, something like that. But the truth, she was a silk merchant's wife.
Yep, she was an ordinary lady. Yep, and she has no eyebrows and no eyelashes, and she's not even classically beautiful, but she, if you're alone with her, she does, you can feel her power. I will admit that.
You do, right? You sort of say, like, to see her, you say there is a way to come in, and you say it's like a 1 minute walk to get there to see this 20, 30 by 20 inch thing.
Well, I actually asked the chief curator of paintings whether he loved the Mona Lisa, and he clearly does not. So I said, are there other paintings that you like better than the Mona Lisa? And so he named five of them, and I have a whole chapter about other paintings that inspire him even more.
Indeed, yeah, and I think you're talking about Sebastian Allard, who you said, name me five other paintings that are more beautiful. But you do point out the trio of superstars. Once again, when you were, in my case, it was being a high school kid graduating, so I went to Paris. There was the Mona Lisa, but also the Venus de Milo and Winged Victory. That, I think, is the triumvirate of what anybody would want to see, even if you're a young kid who doesn't really know much about art.
100%. And, if you can do those three, and you can do those three, if you're really clever in about 20 minutes, and you can leave the Louvre, and then you can say, okay, I did it. Been there, done there.
Okay, I'm
Yeah.
going to embarrass myself for a minute, but just you'll appreciate it because you understand art so well. I decided I want to become an expert in something. So as I was walking around, I stared at this piece. I'm in the frame and I'm looking. I don't get it. It looked like a brick wall to me. And I'm like, what am I missing about this? And so one of the guides, somebody walked by and I said, I'm sorry, can I just ask you, what is it about this piece? Because I don't see why it's beautiful. And he looked at me and went, it's not there. It's out for restoration. So I
Yeah,
was
but you know
indeed
what?
staring.
But you've been a journalist for a long time. I've been a journalist for a long time. The best thing to do is to ask stupid questions, and you just keep asking them over and over again, and then you'll get some answer.
And then react like you're going, I knew that.
Yeah.
Here's what I didn't know. I did not know there was a consultation room that I can walk, anybody can walk in and actually have a moment with an incredible work of art.
Yes. Yes, you have to sign up in advance, and it's a little tricky bureaucratically because the French, have perfected the art of bureaucracy. But you can apply and go and see engravings and watercolors and sketches of all of the greats, and you can actually touch them. You it's I had a research assistant one summer, and she was studying architecture, and when she went with me, she cried. She was so moved. So it's fabulous.
You also said, you said the Louvre at night is a very different place, and that you sort of wondered, are there ghosts in here? First of all, is it open? Can we go in at night?
The Louvre now is open 2 evenings a week, and it's not a bad time to go because there tend to be people who are going out to dinner, and so they only stay for a little while. So the best thing to do is to like go at 7:30 at night, and with your, with your running shoes on, so you can go through quickly. And what you'll find it before the Louvre closes, those 15 minutes, you'll have it to yourself.
I also have to ask you, 1989, the Iam Pei's pyramid was built 69 feet high, 200 ton glass. It's that pyramid looking thing. I think most people identify with the Louvre. Not original. Some people may think it's been there forever. Not until 1989. I guess the first thing I wanted to know is who has to get the Windex and clean this thing?
See, that's the question I asked myself. I thought, what would Frank Meyer ask, my former bureau chief from Chicago? He'd say, how do you clean this thing? How do you wash the windows? So I went out with the window washers. I went out with there's two different teams, the outdoor window washers that wash by day, and then the indoor window washers who wash by night. And with the night guys, I got to stay and dragged it on till midnight. And that's when I learned about that there are ghosts in the roof.
That's amazing. And it's not just all these the buildings and the gallery stuff yourself, but of course the Tuileries Garden. And I remember going into the Tuileries Garden years ago. And you describe it as really it's an open air museum. But am I right? It's only been operated by the Louvre since 2005. In other words, it seems like the Louvre is more than just what the Louvre began as.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it continues to create an empire. You know, there's now a Louvre outpost in Abu Dhabi, and there's another Louvre in the northern French town of Lens. And I've just written a story for the New York Times about going to Lens as the perfect day trip from Paris to discover a Louvre that doesn't have very many people in it, and it's really quite pleasant.
There's so much more to talk to you about this magnificent museum. I mean, the works of Greece and Egypt and other places. I would like to find out why aren't they in Greece and Egypt? What are they doing at the Louvre? But also the importance of ancient versus modern art. The thing is, I need you to stay on because I've got to wrap this show for people to join us again next week. But could you stay with me so that we can do a bonus conversation that will be part of the show when we launch on WGNradio.com and all the other podcast platforms on Monday morning? Can you hang with me for now?
I would be delighted. Thanks.
All right. In that case, I appreciate that. In that case, you don't want to miss this book, Adventures in the Louvre. Check it all out. But join us next week when we're going to talk about other fascinating shows going on in the city. Remember, go to WGNTV.com/store so you yourself can buy all sorts of behind the curtain paraphernalia. I'm Paul Lisnick, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody. Hey, welcome back to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain. So we're in our bonus conversation with Elaine Sciolino of the amazing book Adventures in the Louvre. Maybe you've been to the Louvre, or maybe you're going. You should go. But this is such a detailed book about stuff you don't know, you never thought of. Elaine, what I want to ask you about your first visit to the Louvre, you write that you were a junior in college. As I said, I was a junior senior in high school, but you said you don't remember much about your visit, and all you remember is food, wanting the food.
Well, my father had an Italian food store in Niagara Falls. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and he had a contact in Paris, and she took me out to lunch. And so in my journal entry that day, I have a long description of everything that I ate for lunch, the kind of wine that I drank, what I had for dessert. And then I say, oh, and then in the afternoon, I went to the Louvre in the Tuileries Gardens, and that was it.
I love it. It's not organized like a museum, you say, because it wasn't built to be a museum.
Well,
But is there?
it underscores that you can know nothing and be stupid and still write a book about the Louvre or about any serious subject, because I came to it as a normal person, not as an art historian, and as a street journalist.
If somebody arrives and maybe they're with family and they've allotted X hours to see the Louvre and they're not going to
Right.
see it all anyway, so they say fine. Is there a map? I mean, you get a map. Is there some way you can say this is going to help me find those? I want to see the Mona Lisa, which you said is only like a minute away, not far, if you can find it. But is there a map, something that says we can make your tour a little bit easier?
Yes, there are a number of tricks. One trick is to spend a little bit of money and book a tour. Because if you book a tour with a tour guide, you just say, you know what? Money is for peace of mind. You can even book a tour guide who specializes in kids' tours. Then you're in someone else's hands, you have your tickets, and you have someone to lead you through a special entrance and to show you all of the superstars and all of the must-sees. And frankly, that's something that I recommend if you're stressed and you've got three little kids. I also think when you have kids that what you should do with your kids is bribe them. You know, tell them for every cat that you find, you get a dollar. For every dog, maybe 75 cents because there's more dogs than cats. But if you find a snake, that's like $5. And believe me, you will keep the kids occupied.
What, do you have to pay them?
It's worth it.
All right, fair enough.
It's
So,
like
and
you go to
when you
Italy and you get them ice cream at every single gelato shop. In the Louvre, you just say, okay, find cats, dogs, serpents, snakes, and you have a whole chart and how much money you'll get. They'll
and I'll meet
respond.
you. And I'll meet you back at the entrance in 3 hours.
That sounds pretty
So,
good.
when you said that, I started thinking of sphinxes and pyramids and all that. And so there's obviously a lot of exhibits from Egypt, from Greece, from so many different countries. This is a dumb question, but it's except for like Iraq, where the war destroyed so many antiquities and treasures and such. So let me take that argument aside. But if I am the president of Greece, why am I not looking at the Louvre and going, we want that stuff back. It's our stuff.
The French were brilliant at writing contracts with a lot of governments all around the world. And most, not all, but most of the works that come from various countries, Greece, Italy, Iran, Iraq, were all taken by archaeologists under pretty deep contracts. I mean, for example, the Persian collection, I wrote a book about Iran and spent a lot of time there, but the Persian collection, the Shahs signed an agreement with the French that they could take everything back to France, and the French did.
So that's how it got there.
That's how it got there.
Are there, to your knowledge, this just triggered this question in my mind, but are there any, do lawsuits come up where a particular government says, okay, fine, but we want it back now?
Yes, and there are some cases pending where governments have asked for various objects back, and the Louvre is in the process of considering them. But
By the way, go ahead.
it's a long process because it's not just the Louvre, because it goes from the Louvre to the Ministry of Culture to the President of France. So it's kind of like an art historian lawyer's paradise.
Yeah, I should have probably have said this earlier. There's just the slightest little delay, but you're in Paris right now, so that's
I
where this
am.
conversation
Yes,
is going
I'm in
on. So
Paris.
yeah, so that I should probably have you take your camera and walk the streets with us and just show us around.
We can do
He
another. I'm yours. I love Chicago. Let's and maybe I'll come to Chicago. Maybe someone will invite me and I'll come to Chicago one day.
I sure hope so. I'd love to see you on our morning show in all sorts of different places talking about this because it's fascinating. By the way, here, museums are open and they're free on Tuesdays. My understanding is, I think from your book, that I think you write that the Louvre is closed on Tuesdays, but maybe not.
It's closed on Tuesdays, but I decided to write a whole chapter called Tuesdays at the Louvre because all these people come to the Louvre, and I've been there because I was there today. Today's a Tuesday, and there was a press opening for a big exhibit there. So all these people see people normal other people coming out of the Louvre and tourists, and they're looking to say, wait, how can they can get in and I can't get in? So I decided to write a whole chapter about what to do without ever going into the Louvre, and to discover some of the kinds of art that you would see inside the Louvre, which was really a
Ah.
fun thing to do.
And because of the age of the Louvre, because it's been around, I mean, like here, the Art Institute was built, as I remember, for the Columbian Exposition of 1893. So it has history behind it, but not like the Louvre. And one of the things you write about in the book is that there have been a couple of times in history where the Louvre almost didn't survive, one of which, of course, was Hitler, who wanted to bring Paris to the ground. That could have destroyed the Louvre. But even before that, in 1871, you write about a fire, compliments of Emperor Napoleon III, who was not a son of or grandson, but a nephew of the Napoleon most people are thinking about. But is the Louvre lucky to be around today?
Yes, because the Tuileries Palace, which was attached to the Louvre, burnt to the ground. And the Louvre Library was set on fire, but thanks to some very brave men, including a brave fireman, the fire was put out. The Louvre doesn't face, though, the same problem that Notre Dame did. Notre Dame had a whole forest of wood. The ceiling that immediately burned. What is the enemy of the Louvre is not fire but water, because it leaks everywhere and it's so close to the Seine. that there's always a danger of, since it's in a flood zone, that it's going to flood.
You made me think of Notre Dame there for a moment, right? I mean, where you had the fires, and then I think then in comes the water, and both of those things together create the amazing problem and concern that it did. But I think it's been overcome at this point, and right? I think Notre Dame is back
Notre
in
Dame,
business.
it looks gorgeous. I wrote about it actually in my book. I wrote a book about the Seine, and I discovered when there was the fire in Notre Dame that the water of the Seine saved Notre Dame because the infrastructure on the island where the Île de la Cité wasn't strong enough to pump enough water in, and so they had to get a tank of a boat from the firefighters to Notre Dame and pump the water from the Seine up into the corridors and halls of Notre Dame.
Wow, amazing stuff. I want to add, let me, for folks who are watching us or listening to us right now, and I'm one of these people. It's sort of like I appreciate art. I will go to the Art Institute here in Chicago and other museums. But what has happened to me, and by the way, when I was in grammar school, high school, at some point, we did regular field trips to the art, and each
Yes.
trip
Yeah.
was like a part of history that would, and I couldn't just wait to go to the gift shop. I wanted to buy something in the gift shop. But what, for people who say, look, I appreciate modern art, Andy Warhol and stuff, for me, that's some of that stuff I don't understand. And yet, others, of course, appreciate or don't the works of the modern classics and all that. What, as somebody who understands this so well, what is the distinction? I mean, is old art more important than modern art? I mean, what, how do we better understand the importance of art in our society today?
I wonder if that is the question, or if the better question is, how do you understand yourself and how do you find something beautiful in art? And it doesn't make any difference what kind of art it is or what kind of an expert you are. What I say in my book is that anybody has the right to love art and to fall in love with a statue or a work of art, and it can be. The Louvre, the works in the Louvre only go up to 1848, so there's no modern art there. But just wander around and find something that speaks to you. I mean, that's the best way to see any museum, whether it's modern or classic.
So is there no, I'm assuming you're saying there's no right answer. If I look at the Mona Lisa and say, wow, there she is, because I've heard so much about it my whole life, but I don't quite get what's so great about her. It sounds like what you're saying is fine, then you don't appreciate the Mona Lisa.
And then, yes. And then what I say is turn around and look at this incredible. I mean, if Mona Lisa is looking at a stat at another painting in the same room, it's by Titian, it's a man with a glove. And he's one of the paintings that the top curator thinks is more beautiful than the Mona Lisa. And go fall in love with him. Dame Judi Dench, the British actress, said that if she was stranded on a desert island, she did one of those radio interviews at the desert island, whatever it is, and she said, if I was stranded on a desert island, I'd want to take him along with me, and because she just said she liked having him around because he was so beautiful.
Do you have one of the other interesting thing? I want to go back to the. It's funny. I say Tuileries, and you sort of pronounce it as Tuileries or something like that. You do it obviously more correct than me. But one of the things that's fascinating is to be in this outside garden, and yet if you, it's really a park. I mean, so people are right. You look one way, and there's the Arc de Triomphe. I mean, so it sort of also has the history surrounding it. I mean, it's the kind of experience I imagine when you're in the museum or outside the museum or around, you're just looking at a history of Paris and all directions that has to be moving in and of itself.
Yes, and you can now actually get a good coffee and sandwich in the Tuileries Gardens too, so it's not terrible. And there's places to sit, which is also pretty good.
And you have the three graces to look at.
Yes. And very beautiful Maillol sculptures, which are more modern than what you'll see inside the Louvre. So
So, by the way,
it's a movable feast, to quote
some
someone
people
more
may not
famous.
know that 1848 is kind of a cutoff point. I guess I need to follow up and go, why is it a cutoff point? And one day, do you anticipate there to be an auxiliary location where the Louvre then features post-1848 art?
At some point, the Louvre had too much stuff, so they moved all the stuff after 1848 into another museum, which eventually became the Orsay Museum. So post 1848, you've got the Orsay. Then if you want to see the really modern stuff, you've got to go to other museums like the Pompidou Center. So you can't, it's not like the Metropolitan Museum, which everything's in one building. You've really got to go from one to the other. You know, you want to see Impressionists, you got to go to the Orsay Museum.
And is it a leasing situation? Does the Louvre own those pieces, or it's a we have no room, so Orsay, it's all yours?
Everything belongs to the French state, so that you can do anything you want with it.
Ah, okay. I guess that makes it easier. And I also want to ask you, there are some people, you know, go up to a maybe not a too little of a kid, but at some age, maybe when they're making you go to the Art Institute here or something, and somebody might say, I don't get the point of this. I mean, okay, it's a pretty picture. It's a nice portrait. Why do I need to study this? Why do we need to have this available and we need to go look at this stuff? I want to just go on a boat and go on the water. What's the importance of these museums in preserving the history?
I think of art as a means of learning something about yourself. You know, if you look at a painting of a horrible battle scene, you know, you're reminded of the horrors of war today. You know, if you look at a beautiful sculpture in motion, like the Winged Victory of Samothrace, where she's l landing on a boat, you know, you look at her navel and you think, this is the most beautiful belly button in the world. You know, you have to just spend time letting your imagination go and just say, you know what? I don't really want to be in an art museum today, but I'm going to just look at this like I might look at the Grand Canyon or the gorillas of Rwanda as, you know, a wonderful experience.
Yeah, and we should appreciate that. It was almost a facetious question because obviously,
No, it's
if you don't,
not a facetious
you just.
question at all. It's a very smart question because, I mean, when my kids were little, I shouldn't say this, but they'll probably kill me, but they didn't really like to go to the Louvre.
Yeah, and like I said, and when I was a kid too, I just found it boring. So that's, you know, but now I look back and say, I think that I'm not sure what that was maybe saying about me. I also wanted to ask you, this is half related. You know, I grew up in the 60s, little kid in the 60s, 70s, and so the furniture we had, by the time you hit the 70s or the 80s, it was junk. You threw it out. Now they're antiques. And so you look at something, which I mean, I'll go into a furniture store and they'll be like, we have this antique thing from, and I'm going, I had that in the basement that we sat on that watching television. I'm sort of curious, do you have also have a sense because you know so much about art, what is it about something that goes from it's, and I guess I'm using furniture because it would be different maybe than a portrait, but there is a style you can tie to a period of time, which then maybe goes out of style and then maybe kind of comes back into style. And now it's a clap. One day my basement couch might be the most important possession on the planet.
Well, that may be true, but there is an awful lot of bad furniture in the Louvre. And in Versailles too. I mean, where you in a million years would never want that furniture if they couldn't pay you to take those dressers and divans and canapes.
So it's a matter of taste, I guess. Like once,
It's a
so
total matter of taste.
I want to pose a question to you that you kind of wrap your book with. You ask it of us, so I'm going to ask it of you, which is you sort of ask us to wonder whether or not the Louvre has changed our if we've been there or can it change your life if that visit can change your life. So I guess I have to ask you, has it changed yours?
I have to tell you that this book was the hardest. I've written six books now. This was the hardest of all my books. And it was because the Louvre set up such incredible roadblocks that I had to work with a minder for every interview I did with every person, every official and every employee of the Louvre. So it changed me in that I became a lot more patient. And I also became a lot more surreptitious. So it made me a better reporter, certainly, because I had to go around all of the rules of the Louvre. But it also gave me great humility, which is one of the keys to being a good journalist, I think, that, you know, I could spend my whole life in the Louvre and never master the Louvre. And once you go in with that feeling that I'm always going to learn something. It's it's a great feeling, but it's the same way, you feel about when you go to a wedding reception and you don't know anybody, or you go to a, a fancy gala and you don't know anybody, and you just sort of say, okay, I'm going to have this experience and I'm never going to master it, but it'll be good enough.
You live in Paris now. You said, I know you sort of lived there twice. Is it for work, or are you saying, no, I don't care if I'm working. I love Paris. I'm going to stay in Paris. I love Paris in the springtime, as the song says.
Well, the first time I came to Paris, I was a kid. I was still in my 20s, and actually it's the way I opened my book on the Seine, because I came to Paris because of a personal crisis. I had been married when I lived in Chicago, and one day my husband came home and said he didn't want to be married anymore, and I was a good feminist, so I gave him half the furniture and the BMW and the stereo system, and 4 months later he was married again, and I moved to Paris. So I, the Seine River saved me, because every day I walked over the Seine River, and I had Newsweek magazine behind me. So it was a great transition. The second time I came to Paris, I came with my current husband, who I've been married to for 40 years, and my two kids. And I came as Paris bureau chief for the New York Times. And it doesn't get any better. I think that's the best job in all of American journalism. And I had the time of my life, and my husband's a lawyer. He's still practicing law. And about 10 days ago, we just learned that we have become French citizens.
Congratulations on that, which makes you dual citizens. Can you be dual
Dual
citizens?
citizens, yes. So we are
Okay.
really well integrated into French life now, yes.
Yeah. And I guess finally I have to ask you, when I'm in Paris, there's all those folks who are along the river painting their, images and stuff and selling them, whatever. Do you look and go, oh, those are crap? Or do you go, no, actually, some of them are pretty good.
Actually, some of them are pretty good.
Okay. Then I'm glad I bought some because it is. It's like I'm in Paris. I've got to buy something. That guy's painting a painting. I'm going to buy that.
Listen, Picasso once was on my street that I wrote the book about, and he saw this painting that, and it was like the equivalent of 5 cents. And the guy selling it to him said, "Oh, you can just paint over it because it's just junk, but it's a good canvas." And it happened to be an Henri Rousseau, and Picasso loved it so much that he kept it in his studio the rest of his life. So you never know, that stuff that you bought along the Seine River could be not only just lovely to look at, but they could make you a millionaire or a billionaire.
I need
Yeah.
to get an antique
Yeah,
roadshow.
exactly.
It's so fun talking to you. Merci beaucoup, mon ami. See, there's my French coming through.
Coming
And
back. It's coming back. You got to come
I
to
find, well,
Paris.
I find that when I'm there, it does come back. I also find that they like I'll go into a store or something and I'll try to speak French and then I kind of bow out because I'm not going to make it. And I remember this one saleswoman, I think she owned the store, but she looks, she says, you're doing fine. Keep trying, keep trying.
Absolutely, absolutely. Always speak the, always smile and say bonjour when you walk into a store. They're going to love you when you come back to Paris.
And I imagine they can tell that's an American saying bonjour to me right now.
I still say bonjour with my Buffalo accent.
Fair enough. Yeah, except you get to carry on the conversation. The book is Adventures in the Louvre. It's right here. This is just, I just, I'll be honest. I saw you do another interview and I said, I want to talk to her.
Oh, that's so
A, she
sweet.
looks fabulous and
Oh.
this book looks fabulous. And so thank you for joining me, Elaine Chelina. This is just so amazing that when I go back to France, I'm going to number one, call you, but number two, I'm taking this book with me.
And I'm coming to Chicago one day, and I'm going to have you show me Chicago, because I haven't been there for a few years.
I'll have you tour me in the Art Institute and show me what I'm missing. No.
You
So we'll go
show
to the gift.
me.
We'll hang around the gift shop. Elaine Chelina, the book is Adventures in the Louvre. Thanks for being with me and spending all this time with us. It's just très bien, is my description of our discussion. I wanted to sneak two more French words in there. Thanks for being with me. And
Thank
thank you to our
you.
viewers and listeners for watching us here on Paul Listen Behind the Curtain. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Paul.